Hello, dear listeners. I'm Jimmy Bowens, and you are listening to Episodes. I hope you are well and happy and healthy wherever you are, given the level of tumult this year has rained down upon us all. The end does seem in sight, although perhaps turning the page on a new calendar won't have much effect on what appears to be the most apathetic of viruses. Nevertheless, we can keep learning and we can keep caring for one another. The conversation you're about to hear was recorded on August the 26th, so a while ago now. But the topics covered throughout are incredibly relevant to teaching and learning today. My guest was Mitch Center, an incredibly inspiring educator from the US with an impressive resume of educational experience. Mitch is a highly experienced educational leader. Throughout his career, he's been fortunate to have worked with thousands of outstanding teachers, leaders, and thinkers across dozens of schools. And he is now very excited to have launched Center Educational Consulting, which provides tailored support to leaders in education. Mitch holds a master's in developmental psychology from Teachers College, Columbia University, a master's in educational leadership from Pace University, and he has his principal and superintendent's licenses in both New York and New Jersey. Mitch unpacks a lot of what he has learned about effective teaching and learning throughout this conversation. And there are so many nuggets of wisdom to take away. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. So without further ado, I give you Mitch Center.
There we go. Can you let our listeners know a little bit of background about yourself and who you are and how you come to be Mitch Center?
Absolutely. Thanks. So my name is Mitch Center. I was born with the last name Center, which is always fun because
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, it's my given name. It's my family name. My family came from Russia about 100 years ago, and maybe it was a word that meant center, but it doubles for someone that runs their own company like myself. But I am an education consultant that focuses on leadership development, and I've been working in education for, this will be, I just figured out, my 25th school season. I've worn a lot of hats and played a lot of roles, starting as a full-time volunteer and becoming a teacher, and then making my way up through the administrator ranks within schools, and then also doing district administration where I was managing schools. And then here in the States, we have a wider range of types of school systems, and I've also toggled between a few of them. So I have worked in charter schools, which are publicly funded but privately run. I've worked in more traditional district schools, and through my consulting, I've actually done some work with independent private schools and with some parochial and religious schools. So I try to bring all that to bear in my practice, and I'm always thinking about what can we learn from each other, and that's sort of a guiding principle that I bring to all my work.
So you've had an incredibly diverse experience in education, but was there a point, I mean, I asked this of all the guests on this show because they're all in some way connected with education, but was there a formative period where you realized your self-talk was, yes, I want to be an educator. This is for me.
Yeah, it's a good question. So growing up, I knew that I wanted to work with kids. I think for a long time, without having a name for it, I thought I was going to be a child psychologist. I'm actually the youngest of three kids, and for the longest time, begged my parents for a younger sibling so I could have a baby and a younger kid around, because I liked being around them. I would actually blow out the candles for my birthday every year, and it was a big joke because everyone knew what I was wishing for until I was about 16.
Aww.
But, and so I knew I liked being around kids and knew that I wanted to work with them. And then I actually studied sociology in college and, you know, became more aware of and concerned about racial and social injustices in the world and wanted to have a positive impact. And wasn't fully sure how to do that and was lucky to join up with AmeriCorps, which is sort of domestic Peace Corps in the States. And I was a full-time volunteer in a school, essentially. And that really sort of turned me on to the work. And I saw that being in a school setting, in the classroom, and in other capacities is just a really great way to sort of make change and have a positive influence in the world.
I often hear when people talk about their origin story of becoming an educator, it's the discovery of a purpose and how impactful you can be just by being around people who need some support and guidance.
Yeah, I think I also, just to add, I really did not like school as a kid. It wasn't until I really just in my last year of high school and through college that I really got turned on. You know, looking back, there were definitely teachers that I really liked and some that I really didn't like. And, you know, when you have that moment as an adult and you realize you can be the teacher that has a positive impact on kids and that can turn it around for them, that's pretty exciting. And it becomes, you know, you want to do more of it and you want to have a wider and wider reach. And so ensuring that kids have great teachers in front of them every day was something that I tried to do when I was a teacher, and I've tried to do as an administrator in, you know, helping to develop and support teachers.
I wonder if there's any studies around what kind of people become good teachers? Because I was just thinking, I didn't really like school either. And but I did have some very, very specific individuals who had pretty big impacts. And I wonder if that makes a difference for people then, who it impacts them so much that they remember it for their lives and they remember it changed the course of their lives and then they want to do the same.
Yeah, there has been research done on the effect of having an effective teacher 3 years in a row versus the effect of having an ineffective three years in a row. That's well cited. But there's also been a lot of research in recent years about sort of taking away the magic of teaching and really trying to identify what the core skills are so that they can be taught and learned and mimicked and improved upon. And people say it's sort of a cliche, it's part art and part science. And there's some truth to that. And there's probably some personality types that might be more suited to it in some ways. But a lot of really good teaching practices can be taught if one is willing to learn. And so there's, you know, books like The Skillful Teacher, written by John Safir, and books like Teach Like a Champion, several different places and ways where people have tried to unpack various specific components of what makes for great teaching. And there's no shortage of educators who are out there who came into the field because their own experiences were less than positive. It's a common origin story in a lot of ways, of people who didn't love school and wanted to be part of a profession where they can help change that for kids.
You just made me remember Frank McCourt's book, Teacher Man. I don't know if you've ever read
that. Yeah, yeah.
it's not a textbook, but it is a narrative kind of...
A memoir. He was a teacher at Stuyvesant High School, which selective, gifted, and talented school in New York City. And somebody gave me that book because I think that came out in the late 90s.
It did. Yeah. I read that before I started teaching in New Zealand. And the one story that sticks out of my head for some reason or another is when he had, because he did work with some challenging students to begin with. And this student threw their sandwich on the floor and he walks over and he just picks it up and starts eating it. And I don't know why, but that struck me as such a powerful.
I love that. You know, the passage in that book that has stuck with me is, he said something about when an administrator walks in the room, there's an unspoken agreement between the teachers and the kids, and the kids rally behind the teacher. It's almost like they recognize a newer or bigger or different authority, and they somehow see the teacher, you know, as one of them or something like that. But that idea is fascinating. As someone who's been in, like, I've been in hundreds, if not more, classrooms over the last 15 years, and I think about that a lot.
There's a bond, there's a sort of defense mechanism.
Like us against them.
Oh, that's awesome. So I know you had that work with the core and you, but you quickly got your residency in the new leaders program.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting. How did that affect your perspective of teaching and learning institutions?
So I taught for a while, and then I was in graduate school and actually took on a position as a camp director. For a nonprofit youth development program called Camp Fiverr, great place. And through that leadership experience and my teaching experience, I started thinking about what school leadership could look like. And I applied and was accepted to New Leaders for New Schools program, which was developing at the time urban school principals. And definitely, without having a name for it at the time, it was probably the first time I really experienced imposter syndrome. I think I was 32 at the time, and, you know, who am I to be leading a school as a principal? I, you know, my own childhood memories of what the principal looks like or sounds like and their age and all that.
Well, at least you didn't have the Dunning-Kruger effect.
You're right. But it was a remarkable experience. I learned a ton from them. For starters, when you get into administration, as someone who had only been in the classroom as a teacher, your perspective very quickly widens on what kids are experiencing in school. I think it's human nature to think that, oh, you know, I'm a teacher, I'm doing my best, I try my hardest, and it's probably similar in other classes, in at least in my school, or at least on my floor in my school. And what you realize, or what I realized, and I've had this conversation with a lot of new leaders, they're like, wow, there are some incredible teachers out there. Like, I wish I had seen this while I was still teaching, right? I could have learned so much from this person. It's too bad they have their door closed and are keeping all this great stuff they've been doing for 20 years a secret, or that no one has asked or captured it or shared it. That's one side. And the flip side of that is the, oh my goodness, wow, I feel really badly for the kids who are in this classroom. And I hope to be able to support this teacher in a way so that the kids can have a better experience. But I very quickly realized like the spectrum of quality on both sides was just much bigger than I had ever imagined. I'm not even sure how much I had thought about it as a teacher. So that was a huge, huge early learning as a new leader. Another big piece of that, the beauty of that program was really its sort of cohort approach to supporting us. And so I was lucky to, I had, you know, 15 New York City residents who were all going through the same thing as me. And we would be in schools Monday through Thursday, and we would come together for learning and for support every Friday. And that was after spending a whole summer together in sort of like the crash course on school leadership. And, you know, that sort of peer network is just invaluable. You know, I probably wouldn't have made it without it. And on top of that, we had about 8 other cities around the country that had similar networks. And so we were also tied in and learning from them. But primarily, this group that was right here in New York was really supportive. And I've taken that with me. That's been a huge theme in my career, is particularly in leadership, is how could leaders support one another in their work? Because it could be pretty lonely and it can be pretty isolating. And so
I bet. It seems as if you discovered the need to work with a peer group so as to paint the picture of reality. If there is a spectrum, as you've described, then you're never going to discover it unless you have other eyes and ears to work with.
Yeah, that's right. True.
Now, what compelled you to go from there into a position at a charter school organization? And I only ask this because for the context of our listeners here, you know, charter schools are perceived so differently depending on where you are. And so when I was reading this about you, I thought that's a really interesting journey to take. And I'd love to hear your perspective and what that experience is like.
Yeah. So keep in mind, so the new leaders program, it was a year long training. And then the idea was that we would sort of go out into either charter schools or districts and become either assistant principals or principals.
Oh, wow. And so how daunting.
It was pretty accelerated and intense. And a lot of my peers went out and opened their own schools as principals or took over sort of turnaround schools. A lot of innovation came through new leaders and several other ed organizations at that time in the early 2000s. I joined up with at the time it was called Harlem Success Academy, but it's now referred to as the Success Academies. They're the largest charter network in New York City. And I was won over to their mission, which was really focused on having a huge impact on kids' lives and, you know, establishing proof points that under the right circumstances, all kids could perform at an amazingly high level. You know, for too long, like low-income communities and communities of color in the States have just been really punished by, you know, being under-resourced and from, you know, the community and educators and the whole system having sort of low expectations for what kids are capable of. And, you know, we really set out to prove that, you know, with creativity, with an emphasis on adult development, which was a huge, it's just sort of built into the bones of the organization. So for example, you know, we had 4 weeks of training for teachers over the summer, every summer, compared to like the 2 days, which is typical in a lot of districts. And we were obsessed as well with continuous improvement and with this idea that, you know, our job is to get better at our job. Innovation and not being satisfied with the status quo or being satisfied with not meeting all kids' needs, that just wasn't allowed. And so it was an exciting place to be. There was just a lot of opportunity for creativity. and for fresh ideas. And I was working with someone who is a bit of a political force in New York City schools and politics. And it's true that charters, they're very controversial, for lots of reasons. There's the political component, charters are not always unionized. So that's one aspect of it. There's the economic component. When students leave a district and go to a charter, X amount of money follows the kid. In some districts, it's 75% of the money follows the kid. In others, it's 90%. And so there is concern. And then there's just, the other aspect of it, which is, kind of hard to put your finger on, but, there is a threat when groups come along and try to do things much differently. And so I think that threat was perceived. And so all of that, and then on top of that, in New York City in particular, there, real estate is at a premium. And so it's common for multiple schools to be sharing space under one roof. And so every time a school is approved and is opening, it often means that they're going to be co-located with another school. So you sometimes have a school that is slightly under enrollment, but they're spreading themselves out and they're using all the classrooms, and then along comes a charter school. And sometimes it's not a charter school. Sometimes along comes another district school that wants to open and needs 10 classrooms. And the other school that's there has to figure out how to make it work. And it can become quite controversial in those communities.
It's interesting. I mean, I've been to Harlem many, many years ago, but I always felt that it was a good example of economic polarization in terms of where it is. But the positive side of what you're saying is that at least the charter school organization that you went into was a positive disruption for a place like that.
Not everybody would say that, but I believed that at that time, and I still believe that there's a lot of positive coming through them. But go ahead.
But obviously, because of the nature of charter schools in general, I guess it's hard to guarantee that positivity is the impetus for all of them and for all of the authorities that are trying to run them.
Yeah.
But it's good that you the way you describe that mission sounds like what should be compelling leaders into any school.
Yeah, you'd think so. And it's true. First of all, not all charter schools are made the same, right? And so there are some terrible ones across the United States. And even within charter networks, there are sometimes bad actors, right? And there are reasons for people to, if they're already skeptical of it, they might have, reason to take another look. But there's so much positive coming out of a lot of them that I just refuse to sort of write it all off and say it's one or the other. And so I deeply believe that there's a lot that we can learn in both environments. So for example, I was, keep in mind, I joined the Success Network in 2006, pre-iPhone. and I say that for a reason. We handed teachers, when they got a job there, they were given a cell phone and a video camera and a laptop.
Wow.
And that might not sound like much because now we all walk around with video cameras. But the idea was, we are going to make instruction something that we are going to like really look at deeply and analyze for self-reflection, but also to make it public amongst your peers so that you can get feedback and support. Also so that we can identify and celebrate and spread best practices. And so I left that network in 2010. And even then, we had amassed thousands of videos of teaching practice and had it all in a sort of password protected system where teachers can search, second grade, math, geometry,
What a great idea.
And it was just amazing. We were so far ahead of our time. And it was because we were basically creating a new school district, out of the dust in 2005, and thought, what if we're not correcting for all the wrongs of a system that has been sort of clunking along for decades, what would we want to do? And so in some ways it was like being in a startup or being in Silicon Valley and just thinking outside the box. Again, I don't mean to paint like a totally rosy picture, but that is a good concrete example of how we were doing things differently, and we accelerated teacher growth and student learning exponentially, I think.
Well, that's also a great example of how we need to encourage a little bit more critical thinking when it comes to issues like this. I mean, our charter schools It's just one of those iconic things that can be so easily demonized in a general way, rather than looking at it in a nuanced fashion and going, well, look, Mitch Center has this amazing example of what it can be. And there are examples of those. So it's not always black and white. And if any institution needs disruption, it's education.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping, you know, I'm sure a lot of listeners will agree, but hoping that we can start to be a little bit more receptive to different ways of going about education. And
yeah,
charter schools had a rough start, but I feel maybe it's changing a little bit.
There are just so many, and the politics and types of charter schools vary so greatly. So, I mean, in New York City alone, there's hundreds of charter schools. Just across the country, the level of innovation that's happening in the States really is tremendous. So, you know, I visited a high-tech high charter network in Southern California, which is, like, in my opinion, you know, like the premier project-based learning kind of school. So, for example, in their combined math and science classes, kids are not just designing boats, but building boats and then taking them to the bay to see how much actual weight they can hold. And
that's awesome.
Everything they do, their phrase there is all about authentic audience. So everything they do has to have a real reason. If the kids are writing poetry, then they are going to go to a cafe and do a poetry reading with a real audience, like literally.
Oh, that sounds like edu utopia.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so, you know, when I asked the leader there, so how do you hire for teachers? Rather than saying a lot of the traditional things like, oh, I want someone who's sort of detail oriented or who has a lot of patience, or, you know, he said, I hire for passion. I want to know what people are interested in because I expect them to bring themselves to the classroom. And, you know, that's a fascinating way to think about how you hire. But in a school like that, they're so much more driven by the people than by like a set curriculum that has to be followed. That they are looking for people who think outside the box, people that have devoted themselves to, you know, getting better and to, you know, honing their own crafts and interests, whatever those may be. So that's like a totally different model, but also out there thriving. They do what they can to share what they've learned, but moving the whole system. And by the whole system, I mean like a nation of schools either in one direction or another is so hard to do. I try as much as I can personally to learn what I can from other places. Like, I love visiting schools. To me, it's like tapping into the sociologist and anthropologist in me. It's like, it's almost like visiting another country in the microcosm, what their culture is like and to see how they operate. And so I'm always urging people to get out of your classroom, get into other classrooms, and when possible, get into other schools. Because it pains me. I sometimes go to schools. I worked with a school this past spring or winter before the pandemic, and it was a more of a traditional district school. And I was working with people who were really exactly my age. They had been teaching for 22, 23 years. They had never left their school. They'd only experienced their one school. And I couldn't believe it. And I felt for them because they don't know just how much is out there and what there is to see.
That was a big part of the differences between teaching from my perspective. I relate to that because in Ireland, it's very much that way. You get a job in a school and that's it for your life. You're lucky to have it and you stay there. And then I came to New Zealand, and New Zealand is very transient in terms of teachers. Teachers will work in 3, 4, 5 different schools in their careers, and it's very enriching. Uh-huh. And I think it's a hugely positive thing.
Yeah.
Now, I could, like, there's so many different segues here. For example, I could talk. I have so many questions about High Tech High, but I'll park that for a moment.
In truth, I only visited them for one day, so I'm definitely not the expert. You can, but they have a lot of great stuff online.
Yeah, I'll be searching. I'm sure a lot of our listeners will. But to rewind a little bit with your leadership training, I mean, you became a founding principal of one of the success charter schools.
Yeah.
Charter school. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like? I mean, if you weren't daunted by the fact that you had your training as a leader that was accelerated anyway, and now you were going in to actually found a school as principal, what was that like?
You know, I have to admit, I was very lucky. I joined up with Success in the fall of the opening of their first school. So I was the assistant principal, but they were already a couple months in. I was with them as the assistant principal, and the whole idea the whole time was that we were building a school model that could be replicated. So my boss at the time, her name is Eva Moskowitz, she still runs the organization. She wanted to do 40 schools in 10 years, which, you know, any normal person and I say that with affection, would scoff at that and say, you're absolutely crazy. You know, 40 schools, that's a big district. Of course, you know, 10 years have come and gone and there's over 50 schools now. And I think she hit 41 in 10 years. So she did it. I was there in, you know, year one, school one, when it was just 7 classrooms. Those kids have since graduated high school a couple years ago. But the whole time we were there in that first year or two, we were building, she and the network was building out the capacity for us to open more schools. So it really was a laboratory. So through that year, we were, you know, going to be the principal for, we opened 2, 3, and 4 all at the same time. And so the principal for 2, the principal for 3, and myself, the principal for 4, we were all working in that first school together. And it was a bit of a laboratory. We were really trying to do the best we can to learn as much as we can from as many places as we can, you know, the best ways to build a positive school culture, the best ways to instruct, you know, early childhood literacy and math. We were visiting, you know, progressive schools in sort of well-to-do, sort of fancy neighborhoods in Manhattan. We were visiting various private schools across New York City. We were literally just sponges trying to learn as much as we can from consultants and, you know, all the best thinkers and all the best teachers that were out there. So it was really exciting. And we brought in, we had tons of folks applying. And so that whole winter and spring, people were applying to be founding teachers in our schools. And we had a whole, you know, division of people that were supporting us with that. So it was great. You know, I had mentioned earlier, we were really sort of obsessed with continuous improvement. If a teacher came to apply for us, we wanted them to do a demonstration lesson with actual kids, right? Just to see how they would do with a live audience, so to speak. And so we would, we had planned it so that they would teach for 30 minutes and then we would spend 15 minutes asking them questions and getting them to reflect on what they taught. And we quickly realized that the most valuable part of the experience was actually the conversation and the reflection aspect, because we were really probing for people that can be reflective and be open to hearing feedback. And it was also an opportunity for us to really stamp that value and to really say, hey, we're the kind of place where we're going to come in your classrooms. We're going to want to talk to you and hear what you thought. We're going to want to share suggestions. We're going to want to try new things. We're going to fail sometimes, but this is what we're going for. And so we actually flipped the script. We would have them do a 15-minute little demo just to see how they were with kids and to see what their rapport was like. And then we would spend, you know, twice as much time, 30 minutes, delving into those conversations. And so like even that little story sort of illustrates how, you know, we were really interested in hiring for people with this growth mindset, which, you know, to me is like fundamental to becoming a great teacher.
100%. That's fascinating. Thank you. So you then went into the public system, however, managing quite a large number.
Sorry, my career is bite off more than you can chew.
Because then you went in to manage pretty large number of K-8 schools in Newark, and you were designing the evaluation framework as well there.
Yeah, there's a half step that like on the timeline. That's only worth mentioning because the real story of my career is that I really do like challenges. And I like being in spaces where I can innovate and be creative and surround myself by people that are really trying to create exceptional experiences for kids. So when I left the principalship, my family moved out to New Jersey. I took on a position with a group called TNTP. It used to be called the New Teacher Project. And they were supporting the state of New York on a new evaluation system. So traditionally, teachers were either rated satisfactory or unsatisfactory. It was like an either or sort of binary system. And we know that, you know, it's way more nuanced than that. And by the way, like 99.5% of all teachers were just told that they were satisfactory or sort of rubber stamp, you're good to go. The whole system was shifting in 2010. And they were trying to bring in a 4-point and much more detail-oriented system that wasn't just evaluative, but that was also developmental in nature. And so I was one of the first coaches that was hired to support principals in New York City schools as we were running a pilot. So we had 20 schools for a year, and then we had 100 schools. And then just as it was launching to the entire city of New York, I was brought into the city of Newark, which is in New Jersey, to be an assistant superintendent. And that's where I was managing schools. But also one of the first big projects was helping them with the design and implementation of a new teacher evaluation and support system. I'm stressing that because it's really important. You know, you've heard people say we can't evaluate our way out of this problem or whatever. You know, you can't just tell people that they're not good and move on. You know, you really have to create systems that are supportive of teachers, that articulate, you know, what mediocre versus good versus great teaching looks like. And it's not black and white, and it's really complex. And so that was a great way to enter into this, you know, being in district leadership, which was back in a more traditional setting of a, you know, where I was managing schools and part of a senior leadership team.
You answered my next question, because I was going to ask what kind of problem were you trying to solve, or problems you were trying to solve, and that answers it beautifully, that it's not just about evaluation, it's about the framework or the scaffold within that, which helps teachers understand how to have the growth mindset and to improve, etc.
Yeah, and by the way, it wasn't just teachers. We also developed a new tool for school leaders. And, you know, as an assistant superintendent, at least in that district at that time, what that meant was I was the primary manager of school principals. So they were, when I thought about my team and the people that I was leading, it was those 18 people. And everything goes full circle. In my own way, I was recreating or trying to, you know, the lessons I learned in new leaders about, you know, leaders learning from one another. And so I really tried to develop opportunities for them to share, for them to visit each other, for them to lead each other when appropriate. So yeah, developing a tool for leaders that both articulated the complexity of their role, but also supported them in getting better, so that we can have better evaluation tools, but also better developmental tools. So in a lot of ways, I like to think of like evaluation tools are almost like blueprints for what adult learning should look like. If there's a piece about family and community relationships, like how to do that well needs to be articulated. If there's a piece about providing teachers with effective feedback, both written and verbally, then we need to really dig in and understand what does that look like. That's a good example of a place where principals really can learn from each other, but they won't unless you're really deliberate about it, you know? So for years, you could imagine a principal writes down what they think and they share it with the teacher and it ends there. But again, you know how I said, I became a school administrator, I saw the variance of teaching that exists in the world. When I became an assistant superintendent and started to visit schools, I was like, wow, the quality on both ends of what principals are doing also varies greatly. And what an opportunity to identify best practices, uncover them, articulate them, share them, and hopefully spread them. So that's how I sort of approached that role for those years.
That must have given you such a rich perspective. Would you mind sharing some insights in terms of like practical examples of effective principles that you saw or were developed and ineffective examples that then, you know, needed to develop?
Absolutely. So coming back to this feedback idea, one of the things that I did one day was I had every principal send me an example of written feedback that they had given to a teacher. And then I scrubbed all identifying information out and made a photocopy. So everyone got a stack of 18 pieces of paper. And all they knew was that it was a principal writing feedback to a teacher. And they knew that theirs was in there. They can recognize themselves, but nobody knew who the other 17 were. And we went through each one publicly and said, and I actually always say this, you know, I said, hey, guys and gals, everything that you're reading right now was written by somebody in the room. So let's like remember that and be respectful and like, let's be professional. This is about continuous improvement and helping everybody get better. So I really, and I'm going to say it again, I would repeat myself. And actually I give that speech to people, even when I show videos of people who aren't in the room, I'm like, listen, the reason why educators don't want to be videoed is because they're afraid that their video is going to end up on YouTube and be laughed at by educators around the world. Like, let's be respectful of this person and see what we can learn. Anyway, the essential question was, if you were the teacher, is the feedback clear to you? Do you know what you should be trying to do next? And then we talked about each one. And I urged everyone to take notes. And there were consensus formed on the qualities of effective feedback. And people were able to very easily see which two or three pieces were good. And here's where the magic is. It's not like, oh, well, that must be so-and-so, and she's just such a good writer. It was, what makes it good, and how can you incorporate that into your own feedback? And so they did things like, oh, she used a direct quote, or, oh, she gave, you know, a very specific suggestion with, you know, the page number of the book that the teacher should refer to, or, you know, three really concrete ideas for how the teacher should assess whether or not students understood the question. And then they would go back into their own and they would, you know, just sort of tweak it and try to apply what they had learned. And so that's just one example of the power of how a network could help sharpen itself to all get better, and how the answers often are in the room. I say this to school leaders, you know, you have superstars in your schools. You have one or two or five people who, if they were teaching everybody, this whole school would be different. And so obviously they can't do that, but how can we spread their influence? How can we get everyone to see it in a way where they're open to it and not defensive about it?
On that note about identifying effective educators and then you know, they're all in the room and using that to kind of improve everybody. I like that, the way you said that. It sharpens itself. Yeah. What often tends to happen, however, is you'll have very effective teachers be channeled into middle management and then upper management in schools, and ironically spending less time with students. Was that something that you encountered, or something that you kind of have a strategy against? Or because obviously some people want to build their career and they want to climb the ladder, etc. However, we don't want all these effective teachers to become spending most of their time outside of the classroom.
Yeah, yeah. This question could probably be a whole podcast. I think it's complicated.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's one of the reasons why great teachers move into administration is to sort of help spread their influence. And so if you can find ways for teachers to do that without being administrators, if you can create communities where teachers really have voice and where good ideas rise to the top and where they can either be rewarded financially or otherwise, or empowered to help lead teams or subsets of teams, I think that helps chip away at what you're getting at. But I think, you know, the reality is, at least in America, you know, administrators make more money than teachers. And sometimes it's economically driven. I think a lot of it is well-intended too. I think a lot of people do think they do go through the natural course of becoming a grade team leader or department head and thinking, oh, wow, I'm seeing my positive influence on teachers. You know, maybe I can reach more teachers. And then they do that. But it's a tricky question. I think it's really complicated, and I'm not sure what the fully right answer is. I think it's, everyone probably has a slightly different story.
Yeah, it's probably case by case. And I think you just made me realize that, you know, a good teacher in the classroom will be a good teacher for adults and for professionals also.
Ideally. I mean, I tried, you know, one of the, just quick story going, one of the great things about being in the new leaders program was I was able to experiment around adult learning. And one of the things that I tried doing was I wanted to see if I can get an initiative going, which was basically teacher-led professional development. And so I gave a list of about 20 instructional topics and classroom-related topics to teachers. And I basically said, which of these are things you want to learn more about, and which of these are things you feel like you have expertise in leading your peers? And they were very honest. And it was amazing to me that, you know, like the best kindergarten teacher, this wonderful woman, taught for probably 30 years at the time, she never stood in front of her colleagues and shared what she knew. And just giving her permission to do that was an enlightening for her and for me. And in my career, it was like, wow, if we just give people permission and time and space and make it, you know, a cultural community norm where people will share what they know without others being defensive about it, how much better could schools get and how much better could this experience be for kids? And so, you know, I feel like if you build that into the bones of a school, that's just another way to create teaching environments where, you know, hopefully teachers will be less likely to burn out or will be more likely to find other ways of feeling like they are having a positive impact without necessarily moving into administration.
That's a great story to illustrate that. Thank you. Now, I'm conscious of your time, but I really want to get to your current work.
Yeah.
So that you've laid such a wonderful foundation. It makes complete sense then that you launched into your own entrepreneurial education organization. And so could you tell us a little bit about Center Educational Consulting and how did you arrive at that idea and what made you want to just branch out and do this?
So when I left Newark, I realized, you know, I had worked with, you know, dozens of schools in district settings, many schools in charter settings. I had been in New York. I had been in New Jersey. I was really fortunate to visit all these schools. And I just felt like that I had a lot to share. And the work that I loved doing the most while I was in Newark was really coaching principals. I was their manager, but I also felt like I was wearing a coach hat. And so I really wanted to launch something where the primary focus would be to help leaders and their teams reach their full potential. That's the sort of essence of what Center Educational Consulting is. And so what I do is I coach the leaders one-on-one, which looks different in, you know, various settings. So, pre-pandemic, it was sometimes I would spend a full day per month with a leader in their school. Sometimes I would have, you know, hour-long phone calls or Zoom chats with them for an hour a week or a couple of hours a month. Other times I would work with their leadership teams over the course of the year or through like an intensive experience. Like I've run several retreats and summer institutes with leadership teams. And I really try to keep my ear to the ground. So my tagline is tailored support for leaders in education. Without trying to be like all things to all people, I really do try to listen directly and indirectly and ask directly, you know, what is it that you think, you know, your school needs? And then I try to triangulate that with data and by talking to a lot of people. And then we sort of develop a plan from there, whether it's for the leader. It often involves, you know, the whole team. And sometimes a leader tries to hire me for their team, but really the work comes back to the leader.
Yeah.
So it can't be avoided. And so I really do think that however the leader goes, so goes the organization. And I mean that like from the emotional tone and feeling in the building to the expectations that they have for kids and adults and just right on down the line.
Now, forgive how this question is phrased. I'm not sure if I couldn't think of how to phrase this in the most polite way, but could you describe the difference in a leader pre and post your consultation program in terms of their attitude and the things they realize maybe about themselves and the little bits of growth that you can see happening with what you provide and what type of leader comes out of it?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of leaders get caught up in the fact that they have 10,000 decisions and a lot of technical details that they have to wade through every day. And so, you know, a bit of feedback that a leader gave me a few months ago, he said, thanks for helping me see the 20,000 foot view all the time. You know, he was basically saying like, thank you for always pulling out and seeing the big picture. And part of that is like the luxury and privilege of being an outsider, right? I'm not in the day-to-day because I have been there and I've drowned myself and have gotten caught up in the weeds. But, you know, I take a lot from this idea of adaptive leadership. There are technical problems and there are adaptive problems. Technical problems are those that have like known solutions. So like, what's the new computer system going to be for the kids to log into? Like, that's a technical problem that somebody has very technical skills to answer that problem. Adaptive solutions are more about what are the mindsets and changes of heart that need to take place in order for work to be really moved forward in a different way. Who are, how are we going to get sort of buy-in for a particular initiative and how are we going to really understand what it is that we're trying to solve for and help the whole organization adapt to the changes. So like the pandemic is a great example that I just named the technical solution, but an adaptive challenge is, you know, how are we going to create real community amongst kids who are all sitting at home in their bedrooms? Now that's an adaptive challenge. This is a new problem that there might be a technical component, might be like, yeah, try this app, but it really is an adaptive one in that like, this is new work that we're trying to solve. And usually adaptive challenges require, you know, multiple perspectives and lots of people approaching it from different angles. And so that's a lot of what I try to do.
But leadership is key there as well, I imagine. I mean, that's where that's where we look for leaders in those situations.
Yeah, well, and leaders sometimes try to apply technical solutions to adaptive problems.
Yeah.
So they might think that, you know, oh, well, all we need is more bandwidth and we'll solve the home learning challenge. Well, no, you know, how are we going to ensure that there's real buy-in? How are we going to ensure that knowledge is truly being constructed, or that kids, like I said, feel connected to each other and to their teachers? Sometimes we do spend so much time getting stuck in the technical. And so my job is always to kind of disrupt that, to borrow your word from earlier, and to think like, well, hold on, like what's getting in the way here? What's really underneath all this that's holding us back? And so through a variety of protocols and conversations, sometimes I, you know, interrogate relentlessly with lots of questions. I try to help surface some of that work with leaders. And then there's a whole like other side of work that I do. So I try to do that with school leaders and their teams. And then I also have some bodies of work where I bring together leaders from various places.
Is this masterminds?
Yeah, I run masterminds and leadership circles with you know, leaders from multiple settings. So the masterminds were launched in the spring when the pandemic started. I was thinking, you know, about how to support school leaders who were facing, you know, unprecedented technical and adaptive challenges, right? Like the emotional challenge of trying to keep a place afloat when staff were so stressed and kids were so stressed, and then all the technical pieces like we just talked about. And I was thinking, how could I support them? I have the luxury, again, of being an outsider with, you know, not trying to solve all this. And at the same time, I had a colleague who I've known for years and I've admired for years. Her name is Jen David Lang, and she puts out a newsletter called The Main Idea. And we've been in touch for years and we've talked about maybe collaborating one day. And she similarly had the same thought of like, how could she be helpful to school leaders? And she was talking about this mastermind concept. And we thought, well, let's try it. Let's give to communities something that we could be helpful. And what it is it's communities of leaders that come together to learn together and to solve problems together. And a mastermind is about 10 adults who hop on a Zoom call every other week for about an hour. And we have various topics that we focus on. And like I said, it's collective learning and problem solving. And we ran four of those groups for several sessions just as sort of a give back to educators. And so we had about 40 leaders from all over the country. At one point, we actually had somebody in Thailand, but she just couldn't keep up with the time zone. but they are all over the country, though, from small rural areas all the way up to, you know, school and district leaders in New York City and lots of other cities. And it was so powerful in that, you know, we were able to be responsive to what's coming up in the moment. And we have baked into it problem-solving protocols where people can name a challenge that they're facing, and they get to benefit from the wisdom from the group. And we use a lot of different tools to sort of capture ideas and to share. And what's become of this is like something about a thousand flowers blooming or something. Like, it's kind of grown in a lot of different directions. But the sharing that takes place between these calls and the personal and professional relationships that are starting to develop in these groups is just immense. And so we currently have five groups running. And we've both launched this as an aspect of our consultant work. I do similar work in some other places where I'm convening. In one case, I'm convening coaches of teachers, and we have what's like a leadership circle. It's mastermind-like, but they are all in the same role and working for the same organization. But similarly, we are tackling challenges that are particular to their work. So in this case, as mentor teachers, they're all sort of veteran or retired teachers. How can they support first-year teachers as they prepare for this sort of really challenging new school year? And so, again, we're going through various protocols, naming challenges, trying to study what's out there around virtual learning and around supporting the emotional development of young teachers. Again, it's another full circle moment, but really like it's exactly what I'm meant to be doing, which is just bringing leaders together to better one another and to ultimately have a positive influence on their teachers and then on their students ultimately. Also, inside of all this is we get to learned from all these leaders who we're with, and we're constantly modeling and reflecting back to them some best practices. And in this case, like best practices for virtual learning, because this whole experience cropped up during this virtual time. It's been really exciting and really powerful. And we are open to having, we call them, these are masterminds for school and district leaders. And we are open to working with particular districts or to just have individuals join up and continue with us.
I want to dig into this idea of the paradigm shift we're almost experiencing with regard to education in a pandemic. So from the perspective of school leaders, obviously COVID has been incredibly disruptive. What are some core lines of guidance, just generally, that you could offer school leaders during this time? And then I want to talk a little bit about another perspective, and that is of private companies and edtech. So first, like, what would you say for school leaders who are struggling through this?
Well, first, I would say take care of yourself. One of the first masterminds that we did was about taking care of yourself so that you can take care of others, like sort of oxygen mask theory. So really take care of yourself. And this was especially true. I mean, this is really always true. It was especially true in April and May when people really were in this sort of existential crisis. Like, so, you know, people really had to be told, like, you need to get out and take a walk, and you need to, like, spend 15 minutes with your dog, like the really basic things. And just hearing from others, lights were going off in people's minds and ideas for how to take care of themselves. But really take care of your adults. We've had a lot of conversations about just the emotional safety and the emotional challenge and stress that teachers are feeling. Part of that comes from feeling overwhelmed and like they don't get to make decisions, also overwhelmed by the newness of everything, and then all the personal stuff that everyone is experiencing in one form or another, whether it's like, you know, teaching from home. And I say take care of your adults, I'm stressing that because sometimes we jump over adults and we keep thinking, we go right to the kids. What do the kids need? And it's not like one or the other, but we have to take care of our kids through the adults. And I say take care of them and support them. That's one aspect of it. Another is to really start small and then get bigger from there. Like, I'm a little bit worried that some school districts are going to try to go, you know, from zero live instruction to like a 6-hour live instructional day, you know, where teachers are going to be filling a lot of time with various lectures and other, you know, unsound teaching practices. And so I would much rather see us go small and get good quickly. But to get good at it before we sort of extend the time and the demands. I think some schools, districts, or networks did this better in the spring, and they saw the spring as an opportunity to innovate and to try. And then other districts sort of just rode it out, some by necessity and some because I think they weren't sure where to start. And I think, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. So for example, there's a book that a lot of people are reading right now, The Distance Learning Playbook. So, you know, read a book like that. And figure out like what are the tenets of distance learning, because it wasn't invented this year, you know, it's a thing, and there are good and bad practices, and so it doesn't have to all be, you know, figured out by everybody. I do think we sometimes hurt ourselves by everyone learning lessons that they could have learned from others. And then the last thing I would say is also think about the student experience, you know. So a quick example: if you're thinking about the need to quickly assess kids and figure out what the learning gaps might be, or what we call now unfinished teaching and learning, what the unfinished teaching and learning is based off of what happened in the spring, you know, think about what these first few weeks of school are going to be like for kids. And, you know, we need to build relationships with them. We have to give them a reason to want to turn on their computer screens every day. If we crush them with assessment after assessment and don't realize that the math teacher's giving 3 hours of assessments and the English teacher's giving 3 hours and the social studies and the science, you know, if we don't actually walk through the day in the shoes of a kid, then we are going to be sort of self-sabotaging in unintended ways.
For sure. Yeah. Never has there been a time where authentic engagement is key to progress here in a situation like this. We can't fake it, really.
Yeah. And collaboration amongst teachers so that we all, you know, break out of our silos.
That's a great answer. Thank you. So to switch it a bit now, because we have, I mean, my job is a perfect example of this in the ed tech industry, and my colleagues and other companies. And I mean, this is an incredibly busy time. And now you have an acceleration of private education providers trying to help solve a lot of these problems. But I feel, you know, with that comes some risk, and, you know, we're learning a lot. But for someone, you seem perfectly primed to be a voice of reason here for both parties. So I want to ask you what kind of advice or guidance you would give organizations like that when they're approaching schools and teachers and leaders to help solve problems.
I think my advice to ed tech companies would be similar to my advice to the ed tech departments in schools and districts, because sometimes there's a little bit of like, men are from Venus, women are from Mars, or whatever that is. You know, like they're almost like they're living in the same place but speaking a different language. You know, I've seen this at a school level. You know, where like the teachers and the tech folks are just not speaking the same language, and I've seen this play out in districts, charter and district schools, where like they just either don't understand each other, or they're sort of seeing or speaking past each other, where like the tech team is developing all these tools, but they've skipped over like steps A, B, and C that would even allow someone to want to try those tools, right? And so my advice to the tech teams is always, you have to be there side by side with educators to really understand what their challenges are. And so I would say, as much as possible, like, roll up your sleeves. Don't create solutions in a vacuum. Don't create solutions just because you have three people on your team who used to be teachers themselves and they think that they need something. Like, it really needs to be meeting a need. And then you need to really be listening to your constituents and your communities and schools to understand what is or isn't working about the tools that you're providing. I personally think that one of the biggest challenges around ed tech is that things are more complicated than they should be, and that the best solutions are the simplest ones. And I'm not saying this to disparage anybody. I think that teachers have a million things to do at once. And I think that all adults, one of the reasons why iPhones are so popular is because they're easy to use, right? You don't have to be in the tech world to feel really competent and dexterous, like in moving back and forth between apps and such. And so I think that, like, to the extent that you can figure out what it is that you do and do it well, sometimes, you know, an ed tech company will come out and they try to be everything, and they create these monster programs that just become really cumbersome for people to use. I've used tools like that, like even around, there's different ways to like capture teacher feedback, you know, and there's tools that are like way overly complicated, and there's others that are more elegant and easier to use. So like, can I name a company? Like,
oh, sure.
An example, like a tool that I like right now is Padlet. Super easy. You know, you're trying to find a way to get everyone to literally look at the same page and to collaborate on a document. And I've been joking lately that I've just been using it so much lately. I'm like their spokesperson, but I'm not. I really am not. I don't know anything about their company. I'm new to them. I've only been using Padlet for about 4 months since the mastermind started. And I have found it to just be a really great way to get people there. But again, it's because it's simple. It doesn't try to be all things. They basically say, hey, we have these 8 different ways of getting people to collaborate. Try it. And it's just really easy. It's never failed me. It's like, it doesn't seem to be buggy or anything like that. I would just urge people to really keep their ear to the ground and try to be responsive to what schools say they need, not just what they think they need. I have probably more advice for schools saying, hey, be on the lookout for all these companies that are going to try to come and come at your budgets, you know? So like, be judicious, try the programs, field test it with everyone that's going to use it. If kids are going to be using it, have the kids use it before you buy it. And I think that's fair to say, right?
Like, of course, yeah.
Sometimes things are really shiny and exciting in the pitch, and sometimes school leaders have really big budgets and big appetites, and they take things on before really letting their teachers and kids crash test it. So that would be the flip side of that question.
Yeah, I agree. Things need to be tested.
The last thing I'd say about it is I'm one of those people that never believes that tech will replace people, and I'm sure that you agree. And
of course,
that, you know, we have to just keep gut checking. Like, is this enhancing our relationships and our connections, or is it taking away? And like, I think that's a it's a worthwhile question, probably with all technology endeavors, like in this world that we live in, you know, with so much like innovation, like, is this making life better or is this making us more distant from one another? Because I do think that at the end of the day, we all crave to get back to a place where we can benefit from technology, but just, we need each other. We want each other. We get energy from each other. We love each other.
Yeah. I've thought a lot about that recently. Again, it's something that can't be faked. If you are using a tool of any kind, if it doesn't make you feel enhanced in some way, but you know, the emphasis on the ego, you know, then it's not going to have longevity.
Yep.
So that's a very good point. And I feel, although it seems somewhat abstract, it could be unpacked a bit more. Maybe there needs to be more dialogue around that. I mean, how does a student feel about themselves when they're using a particular app or a program? How does a teacher feel about themselves as they're working with it? Is it adding more stress, or do they feel like they have more purpose, more valuable? Those are hard questions to ask.
Yeah. I mean, I think asking kids what they think, I learn more from my own two children as a built-in focus group than I, yeah. and I mean, I'm a big, big proponent of student surveys, and there's a lot of them out there, whether it's about tools or even, you know, there's a students' perceptions of teacher effectiveness survey that's out there. It's called the Tripod Survey. I've been a fan of it for 15 years. Kids know. They know what works when it comes to the adults that are in front of them and the curriculum that's in front of them, even or about other kids, and about the tools that they're being asked to use. And they'll tell you why if you give them that space. You know, what do you like about this tool? Does it help you learn? Why or why not? And they'll tell you, and you'll hear different and sometimes conflicting answers, but that's surveys and you have to weed through that.
Yeah, sage advice. Thank you. Oh, there's so many different directions we could go, Mitch. And I'm sure maybe we can do this again, but I've just got a few quick fire questions to close before I ask you to give us some ideas on where people can find you. So if that's okay, I'll just fire off a few of these and whatever comes to mind answer. What are you reading at the moment? And are there any specific books you'd recommend right now for your leaders and teachers?
I am going my second round through a book called Permission to Feel, written by Mark Brackett from the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence. It's all about the importance of emotional intelligence. And I'm doing a book club with a couple of groups of first-year teachers. The idea is that, you know, EQ will help us in many ways with our decision-making, with our relationships, with our ability to learn. And so it's all based around this program and this way of thinking about recognizing, understanding, and labeling your emotions so that you can express them and regulate them effectively. It's important work for adults, for leaders, who I do think set the emotional tone of a building, for teachers who set the emotional tone of a class, and then ultimately benefits kids. If you can get kids to really talk about in nuanced ways how they're feeling so that they can understand and get some power over it. It's powerful stuff.
That's great. Yeah, I'm currently enjoying that process with three toddlers that live downstairs.
Oh, great. I recommend it. You know, there's a really great tool in it called the Mood Meter. And if you just search Permission to Feel Mood Meter, it's all over the internet. It's basically a colorful meter that also is a great vocabulary builder with your three young kids. Which will give them lots of ways to say how they're feeling besides good. You know, how you doing?
I love it.
Good. No, you know, and goes past happy and sad. And so it's actually great for kids and adults of all ages to sort of start taking a more nuanced and reflective look at really how they're doing.
Oh, that's great. I can't wait to look that up. You advise school leaders to greet students at the door each morning.
You read my blog.
I enjoyed it. I really did. I think, you know, that's wonderful. And I've had principals who did that. I've had principals who didn't do that. But can you just explain in a few sentences, why is that important and how might leaders take that advice and use it?
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's just like it's a basic thing you can do to establish personal connections with kids. It also shows to teachers and families and parents that you are accessible and that you're out there It's a chance to project an aspect of yourself. You know, so people aren't wondering, you know, where's the principal, who's the principal, et cetera. The flip side of that also is, you know, a lot of schools are asking their teachers to do that. You know, there's a lot of evidence now that when teachers stand at their door and greet kids every morning, that disruptive behaviors decrease and learning time increases. There's actually been studied. And so I've worked with several schools that have tried to make that a school-wide norm. Where you greet kids, especially in middle school and high school, where kids are changing classes all the time, and you greet kids, and you know it's just a high five or a handshake kind of thing in a pre-COVID world, and you know you get to check on them, and you know of course if there's any outliers or kids who are feeling particularly upset or angry, you just you get your finger on the pulse, and then I've actually seen schools where kids start taking that on and leading it, and you know you can just see how community is built just by a simple gesture.
Absolutely. This is not a question that generally would be answered in a quick one or two sentences, but I'll ask it anyway. In your opinion, what is the most impactful aspect of literacy development efforts?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question because the first blog I ever wrote was called Reading in School. And it was basically, I was inspired to write it because as someone that has spent so much time in schools, I'm sometimes shocked at how little kids read in school. I play tennis and I don't get better by hearing somebody talk to me about playing tennis. I get better by playing tennis. And so this sounds obvious, but I really do think that being really deliberate about the time that kids have to read and what they read and ensuring that all adults who are with kids understand some fundamentals of reading instruction, right? Like you don't give kids text that's like three grade levels ahead of what they're prepared for. And you know you're deliberate about the vocabulary that you're introducing, and you're previewing, you know, what might be challenging, like basics like that. But you know, science teachers should have some know-how, and social studies teachers should have some know-how. And time needs to be made in school for kids to read books and good books. And again, we need to ask kids and families and teachers, like, what are the good books? And we should design our schools around that as a fundamental principle.
Simple, but as you said, often it doesn't happen. And yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Well, so often I think there's an assumption that kids are going to read at home. Yeah. And we have these reading logs. And you know, once you become a parent, you realize how absolutely difficult that can be. And I've tried to do it and sometimes was successful, but I've had many days or weeks or months in my life where it's just been really hard to ensure that my kids are reading enough at home. And when they're in school all day, you know, it's just the time is there and I think we should use it.
Slightly changing tact here a little bit, but rewrite society in three words.
Remember to vote.
That's so perfect of an answer, honestly. The next one is, what is your go-to work slow motion confidence walk soundtrack?
That's so easy. It's Eminem's Lose Yourself. You know, vomit on a sweater already, mom's spaghetti.
Nice.
You know, there's no better lyric than that when you are, you know, about to step onto an auditorium stage to address a group of kids, or even like, I remember being a first year teacher or like just an early year teacher and like walking through the hallway and going to greet my kids in the schoolyard for the first time. And like, that's just a good soundtrack for like facing your fears or, you know, getting yourself amped up.
Great choice. What should school leaders worry less and care more about?
I think they should worry less about feeling like they have to know everything. You know, I think there's so many questions that come to them and they're so used to being the answer. And I just think if they can worry less about feeling like they have to know everything and worry more about building a culture of caring and of trust and of high expectations so that like a community could actually create together and could imagine together and could like adapt to the things that they can't change, you know, together, you know, like right now leaders are asking their teachers to adapt to the impossible. Some of them are saying you're going to come into your empty classroom and you're going to teach to a group of kids that are all in their homes. Others are saying you're going to come into a classroom that's going to have 10 kids while the other 12 kids are at home, you know, and principal's not making that decision often, you know? And so, but how can we all get comfortable adapting to things that are outside of ourselves? We can only do that if we really know each other, if we really trust each other, if we really believe that everyone has kids' interests at heart, if we actually care about each other. So, but stop trying to control everything and stop trying to act like you have all the answers to all the things and remember that you're not alone. Like, you're in this with a group of people who, you know, could navigate change together.
Well said. Last question. Where is the train in the background coming from and where is it going?
I live in like what's, yeah, sorry about that.
No, it's wonderful.
It's so I live in like a commuter town. And so there's an express train to New York. It's 29 or 35 minutes, depending on which one you catch. It goes to Penn Station in New York. So I live like,
oh, how romantic.
If you left Manhattan and just walked west for 18, 20 miles, you would land at my apartment. So that train, I live right next door to it, is coming in or leaving the station.
It's a really good visual. It's great. Yeah. So Mitch, how can our listeners get in touch? And I mean, if they want to engage you for the consultation service you offer, what's the best way for listeners to do that?
Great. Thank you for that opportunity. First of all, thanks for this. This is my first podcast. It's been fun talking. I know that when you ask people to talk about themselves, they tend to do a lot of that. And so I think I just fell victim to
Well, look, all of it was fascinating.
This is great. I do appreciate the time and questions. But so my last name is Center, just like it sounds. And so it's Center Educational Consulting. So my website is www.centereducationalconsulting.com. And my email is just Mitch, which is my first name, M-I-T-C-H, Mitch@centereducationalconsulting.com. Yeah, send me an email and we can figure out a way to connect and to talk. And I'd love to set up consultation calls just to get to know people and to understand what they're looking for or what they think they're looking for, or even to just brainstorm ideas. I also, I try to share as much as I can. And so because I read a lot and subscribe to a lot of different things, if people are looking for a resource and aren't necessarily looking to work with me, they just want an idea about something or an article, I'm always happy to share what I have access to and, you know, to pay it forward as best I can.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you. So I really enjoyed this. I mean, some takeaways for me, listening to you and chatting with you, Mitch, is that there's just a very clear requirement for all of us to be a bit more collegial and collaborative.
Yeah.
And the key for our students is to step back a little bit, to give them room to breathe and to build relationships first before expectations around academia. And I think, you know, you've given me a lot of things to think about in terms of taking care of our adults. That's not something you hear very often. So that's really a refreshing message that's come out of this conversation.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you. This has been really wonderful.
Thanks so much. And hopefully, maybe next year sometime, if you don't mind, we'll hit you up again and we'll do a part two if you're open to it.
Yeah, I mean, truthfully, the way the world is moving right now, in 2 months, we're going to be in a whole new circumstance, or 4 months.
So that would be great. It would be great. I'd love, because just based on your work, you're going to get so many fresh perspectives based on what's happening in the world. And that'd be lovely to chat to you again. All right, Mitch, I'll let you go. Thanks so much again. Take care.
Hey, thanks a lot. I really appreciate the time and opportunity. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening. If you're new here, please consider subscribing on your podcast service of choice, as we release new episodes regularly. Also, if you have any comments, questions, or guest suggestions, please join us on our LinkedIn group, Teaching and Learning in a Digital Age. Finally, a huge thanks to our producer, Paula Prowse, and editor, Yasmin Nowak. That's it for now. Take care, stay happy, and keep learning.